Okay. So, welcome everybody. This is day one of the RA convention, Limud. Danny Nevins here, and we're going to be talking about lab-grown meat, or cultured meat, or in vitro meat, or magical meat, or something like that. It's sort of the new frontier of kashrut. And I've got a little introduction, and then we're going to have some chavruta time, so we've got like a little setup here for that. But before we go further, maybe people could say who they are and where you work or where you live or whatever. Okay, Ravid, you want to start?
Sure. I'm Ravid Tillis. I'm an assistant rabbi at the Merrick Jewish Center in Merrick, Long Island.
I'm Shira Wallach. I'm one of the associate rabbis at Sheriff Israel here in Dallas.
Ruben Barkin. Savannah, Georgia, we'll work there.
Ellen Nesson, I live in Morristown, New Jersey.
Adina Weber, I am the wife of Ruben Barkin, and I am, a year from now, will be a social worker.
Great. Shatova.
Joel Alter, I work in the admissions office at JTS.
Ethan Seidel, rabbi, pulpit rabbi in D.C., here in Israel.
Jonah Lehman, congregation rabbi in suburban Washington, D.C. and Maryland.
Paul Drazen, Special Projects United Synagogue.
Great. Great. All right, so welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming. We're going to start with a little video, and it's only a two-minute video. I asked Hashira whether we could get, you know, a big screen. She says, well, it's $500 for a two-minute video. I said, no, we can look at my laptop. So you're stuck with a small screen, but... this is about the production of lab-grown meat, and so bring it a little closer. But just tell me that angle is good, and let's do this.
The muscle tissue is a key component of the meat we eat, and is first harvested in a small and harmless procedure. Next, the tissue is cut into minuscule pieces to separate the muscle fibers and cell. And this is how it looks close up. The muscle tissue consists of fat cells and muscle cells, which are separated to produce cultured beef. By dissecting the muscle cells, individual cells can be removed and cultured. The cells start dividing. Eventually, from one muscle cell, more than 1 trillion cells can be grown. These cells naturally merge to form so-called myotubes, which are no longer than 0.3 millimeters. The myotubes are then placed in a ring around a central hub of gel. Muscles' innate tendency to contract causes them to put on bulk, growing into a small piece of muscle tissue. From one small piece of tissue, this pioneering technique can produce more than a trillion strands. When all these little pieces of muscle are layered together, get exactly the same thing we started with, beef.
So, that's what we're talking about. That's a YouTube clip, which maybe I can get a little email list at the end of this session, maybe, and I can send people the link to that and to some of the other publicity that's come out. What happened was there's a team at the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands led by a guy named Mark Post. Mark is a, I don't know him personally, but Mark, he's a medical researcher, an MD, PhD, and his field is sort of vascular systems. You know, there's a lot of, with heart disease, there's a lot of need to sort of regrow damaged tissue. And so so that's his interest, and yet he started to look into the possibility of doing it not only with human heart tissue, but also to create muscle tissue for eating purposes. Now you might say, well, what in the world is the point of that? It's extraordinarily expensive. Who knows what the product would be marketable? Are people going to want to buy synthetic or cultured and neat. But part of the motivation, hi, welcome, come on in. I restart the, oh, you're working again. That's a great thing. Called you back into service for the, all right, great. So part of the motivation is environmental, because if the human population of the Earth is expected to grow to 9 billion people in the future, then how are all these people going to eat? And the fact is that in the developing world, especially in China and in India, there's a great desire to eat meat. Even societies that didn't typically have a lot of meat, meat in their cuisine, are now trying to have a lot more. And so we all know that the production of beef takes an enormous toll on natural resources. A lot of forest land is cleared to make more pasture land. There's an enormous amount of pollution that comes as a result. Even bovine methane, you know, basically cow farts, are an enormous environmental problem because methane is much worse for the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Those are all just sort of like environmental issues. But then there are ethical issues. I do eat meat, I will say that from the outset, but I'm concerned because I realize that it's very hard to create a product called beef without suffering. And so if you were to find a way to create a hamburger or even a steak without a nervous system, basically just the meat, no animal that has to live in terrible conditions and be bulked up and all that stuff, all the suffering that we know about, then that would be far better as an ethical solution. There's also health benefits that are at stake because, first of all, as we all know, the meat industry uses antibiotics to help bulk up meat, both poultry and beef, and yet we're ingesting all those antibiotics, so it's not good for human health, not to mention the animal's health. And so if you could grow this tissue in a laboratory situation where you could be in a sterile situation and you didn't need that same amount of antibiotics, then it might be a real benefit for human health. Right? So environmental benefit, ethical benefits, human health, and animal well-being. And then there's also energy consumption. It's actually quite of a drain on our natural resources to create beef the way we do. One team also in the Netherlands came up with a study, and this is all very conjectural, you know, because there's no industry right now for this product. But they found that in laboratory conditions, in theory, doing basically what you just saw in that video, it would be possible to create this product, this meat, with much less use of electricity, certainly of carbon, you know, based fuels and so on. And so if that's the case, then we've got a strong motivation. Now, I'm sure many of you read maybe that's why you came to the session, you maybe read the newspaper last summer. In August, there was this media event where Mark Post and his team produced enough of these mild tubes that they turned into meat that they were able to actually create a hamburger, the $325,000 hamburger. And a lot of people said, oh, that's ridiculous. But the reason they did it was what they call a proof of concept. You know, it's a way of saying, you know, this isn't just science fiction. We can actually do this. And here it is. It's pink. It goes in a skillet. It's oily. You know, you fry it up, and now you can chew on a hamburger. But they're a long, long distance away still from having something that's economically viable. And not to mention other issues like taste, mouthfeel, which is, I guess, in food science, one of the things that you look into. You know, how does it feel in your mouth? You know, this past Friday night, I made Shabbos dinner for a group that was half meat eaters and half vegetarians. And I was making Indian food. And so I made a chicken curry, and then I used the same curry sauce before I added the chicken, I split it in half. I did seitan for one half of the group and chicken for the other half of the group, you know. And I'm always interested, you know, how does the seitan feel in your mouth compared to what meat feels like? And so they've got a way to go. Still, I'm interested in this because it really has some perplexing halachic sides to it. And already last summer, when this was first reported, a bunch of rabbis started weighing in. And so I volunteered to write a tshuva for the law committee on the subject, and I'm right at the beginning of my research. So what you are my lab rats, right? You're basically, you didn't know that you were signing up for this experiment, but the thing is that you're my colleagues, and I have some basic approaches that I'm thinking about, of like, what are the issues? And I'm hoping that in this conversation we'll generate some other questions, and maybe some of you will have other ideas of sources or concepts to be exploring, and that'll help me along the way. I've done this with other projects. I go on the road and I sort of talk it out, whether it's at a RA convention or Ramah camps. This summer I'll be at a few camps and I'll try to teach about the subject and see what the kids have to ask. But the tshuva I wrote on electrical devices on Shabbat, I first taught it at the RA convention that was at JTS about five years ago, something like that. And it was a great session. And as a result, I really had some help in getting myself started. So I'm thankful that you came for more than one reason. Okay, any questions so far on what I've said? Okay, so a little bit more about the process. From what you saw there, the process described there involves a biopsy of a living cow. So the way they showed it there was like from the butt of the cow, but I've heard that they actually take the cells from the neck of the cow. So they go in and they take out a little piece of flesh. So obviously the first thing you want to worry about is, well, first of all, tsar bali chayim, does this thing hurt the animal? And then second, aver min hachai, is this a limb taken from a living animal, which we know is a big no-no, right? Then there's also the question of like, okay, now that you've taken cells out, what is the status of those cells? Are they, should they be treated like meat? Should they be treated like eggs? Are they perhaps like milk? These are all substances that come out of a living animal. They're poresh min hachai, right? How much do we extend the categories of these other things? Is it aver? After what is an aver? The rabbis don't think that it has to mean like a whole limb, like an arm that's got bones and muscles and ligaments and all that. Even an organ would be considered aver min hachai. What is the shiur of aver min hachai? What's like the minimum amount? And is there a difference between Jews, the Isser of Eivor Min Hachai for Jews versus for non-Jews? As you know, Eivor Min Hachai is one of the Shivat Mitzvot B'nei Noach, and it's paradoxically possible that it's stricter for B'nei Noach than it is for Jews, because Jews get shiurim like a kazait, whereas apparently for non-Jews there's no application of these minimum amounts, so it's therefore it's bekal shehu, you know, like our issue with chametz. So those are some of the issues. Then some of the issues I'm interested in are, well, if the cells came from a non-kosher animal, right? Is it, if you could take cells from a pig, you know, and then you were to cultivate it into a pork chop, you know, would that be kosher? Is it arguably kosher? Right. Then I've just recently started to think about something else called synthetic biology. Synthetic biology is when they copy the code of DNA, and then they can actually generate a completely synthetic cell, right? Using 3D printers and stuff like that. I mean, like, we're entering a really new period. And so if you were to say, well, okay, I'm going to take this cow, I'm going to copy its genetic code, and then I'm going to replicate that, not taking a biopsy, but just taking the information of the cow, right, and creating that, would that be kosher? Right? Would that even be meat? And that's another question. This product that Mark Post is putting together, do we consider this to be meat, or is it possibly parv? Right? Would it be good for it to be parv? Right? You know, when non-dairy creamer was first created. I don't know what years it was, in the 50s or 60s, when food chemists first came out with this. The rabbis at the time said, you have to serve it in its carton. You may have a very fancy crystal and china type of dinner.
Margarine, too.
Right, margarine, too. But it has to be in its carton. Otherwise, you know, you've got a Marianne issue going on here. And people say, "Is this a I thought I was at a kosher establishment. It's not a kosher, right?" So you had to put it in the carton. Eventually, we now don't feel that way because we got used to the fact that there's non-dairy creamer. But could it be that way, that this meat would initially need to be... you know, be considered fleishig because people wouldn't be able to tell, or
in a petri dish,
right? Right. You know, and it does look funny when you know, at JTS in our cafeteria, we've got bacon and sausage and all those good things. You know, and there is a little bit of that Marianne, but it could be that in 10 years that this becomes a product which is available commercially. Maybe it's 20 years. I don't know. But it could be that there comes a moment when there is livestock beef and lab beef, and that those are two different options. And you may say, well, people are already worried about GMOs, you know, genetically modified organisms in their corn and stuff like that. They don't want to buy that. Al-Khad Kama Vakama, wouldn't it be more so with beef? But maybe not. You know, maybe if it winds up that the environmental and ethical and health benefits are all strong, it could be that this becomes a viable product. And the last thing I'll say is, you noticed in that little video, they showed how they take these cells and they separate out the beef, the muscle cells from the fat cells. We all know that fat tastes good, you know, and so when you have a hamburger or you have steak, it's actually, I mean, eating pure fat is disgusting, but eating pure muscle without any of that means it's sort of tasteless and dry. So they would then have to sort of engineer a product where there are sort of layering these little tubes of muscle tissue with beef with fat tissue. The product that they created initially, hi, welcome. Sorry. The product that they first created was, I believe, pure muscle tissue. Right? I don't think that they layered. And the reason that they made it into a hamburger is because they're growing it in that petri dish that you saw, right, with around this hub of gel. And the muscle tissues, as they develop, they start to flex against each other and to bulk up. So that's good. Still, they're grown on a medium which is rich in proteins, right? And so that's basically blood, right? So one of the questions, bovine fetal serum, I think it's called, which is apparently a very commonly produced liquid in the medical industry, but we clearly would have issues with the medium that this stuff is grown on, right? You could say, well, the cells were taken from a kosher animal, but now they're being grown in a novella, you know, in a dead animal medium. Maybe that fluid is Eiver Min HaChai, right? And so these are all complicated issues. But what I was starting to say is the reason why they haven't grown a steak yet, like a ribeye, you know, as appealing as it might be, is that to have that thick of a structure, you actually need channels. You need basically capillaries to deliver the nutrients and to the cells so that they can grow. And so far, what they're able to do is to create these tiny little strips that are just sort of bathed in this fluid, right? And that can get to all the cells. So it seems that there's a lot of different steps left before this becomes a viable product. Nevertheless, it's an interesting product, and I thought it would be worth talking about. Right? Any questions? Okay. Please, yes.
Did I miss any handouts?
Not yet.
Okay.
What you missed was the introduction and also a little video that we saw, which showed it's a video made by a team in the Netherlands that produced that first $325,000 burger. And it showed that they take a biopsy from a living cow. They isolate the cells. Basically, they're looking for stem cells that are then, through different stimulation, turned into muscle cells. right? Then in a petri dish, they're sort of cultivated into what are called myotubes, which is like a strip of a bunch of these cells, right? And then eventually, as they grow in a circle around this thing, they begin to resemble muscle tissue. They're split, and then they're sort of assembled, stacked into meat, right? And so that's what we were reading about. One other thing I'll say is that Rabbi Menachem Gnack of the OU, he said something about, well, it could be kosher, but it would have to be taken from a shechted animal, right? So that's an interesting thing, because that would obviously deal with the Aver Min HaChai issue, right? So so if you can get stem cells out of a behemish kuta, then that would solve that issue.
And Sar Balei Chaim.
And Sar Balei Chaim. Yes. Although, you know, arguably with the biopsy, they could, you know, give a topical anesthetic so it wouldn't hurt the animal, you know, arguably. But
but it certainly wouldn't hurt it after it's already been checked.
Yeah, that is true.
How are the cells good if the animal's dead?
Right. Well, they'd have to do it very quickly. Yeah. So, but then there's also the question of, well, if you're taking basically meat from a dead animal, then that's fleishig.
Right.
As opposed to something that's poresh min hachai, that's separated from a living animal, in which case it's arguably parv, right?
Why would it be parv if the animal hasn't died yet?
Like an egg, that's the way I think of it.
Oh, yeah, that would be different.
See, eggs that are found inside the body of a shechted chicken, let's say, I believe are considered fleishig, right? Not parv. Right? It has to separate from the living animal in order for it to be considered parv. And so that's an interesting piece of it, which is, I think there could be some benefits to finding a way to take it from a living animal as opposed to from a dead animal. If we could deal with the Aver Min HaChai and the Tsar Balei Chaim issues. Again, I haven't come to any conclusions. These are sort of some of the questions. Yeah.
More about the blood that you said, the bovine fluid.
Yeah.
What is that?
I think it's called bovine fetal serum, I think it's called. And I think it's when a cow is slaughtered and they find a calf in utero, you know, and they can take some of the serum from its, you know, its blood, basically. And apparently it's very rich in stem cells, you know, and the calf. Yeah. It's sort of like when they were getting human stem cells out of umbilical cords and aborted fetuses that's where they were looking to get them. Now apparently it's possible to get stem cells even from skin, you know, obviously it's much better to get from skin cells and to be able to reverse the clock, turn those cells back into stem cells, and then manipulate them again into the direction you want to go. But, you know, then that raises all these other issues. Does it have to be from a cow? I mean, like, if these cells, could it come from a kosher animal? And I was reading on the plane over, you know, Rambam's, his Hilchot Machalot Asurot, and which is fascinating. Apparently, there's not a love on eating human flesh. It's that it's not part of the assay of, you know, these are the animals that you can eat, right? And so, Joel, do you want to say?
Very close to the issues you've laid out, but I think different, is what I would call a tachlitic question.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, who are, you know, who function as a posek, I'm very interested in you saying the word about your willingness to consider the tachlit of a given action. What I'm asking is, the Torah's grant for us to be able to eat meat comes in a very particular context. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't stay in that context. It does start there, and so I'm wondering, since one of the Torah's lead concerns with the eating of meat in general is that we not eat it with the blood.
Right.
It seems to be related to our ethical concern and concern, you know, in God's creation that we are taking a living thing. Mm-hmm. Might it be that this meat misses the point of meat and therefore oughtn't be eaten? Right? That dafka, the meat we should be eating, is meat that has lived, is from an animal that has lived and rejected, so that we may... I'm not sure I agree with this, but I'm just playing out the thought. Right? Like, if the tachlit... eating meat is to express a concern, this is missing the point.
I can imagine... let me extend what I think you're saying, right? Which is that... So now we have a world where people eat meat all the time, but they're not eating it from livestock, right? So all the Torah of Shechita is gone now. Right? Melicha, Dine Melicha, perhaps we're not doing anymore. Basar B'chalav, maybe we're not doing anymore. And so, and the whole thing of Kisui Hadam, and the Chalev, and the Gid HaNasheh, and all sorts of like mitzvot and particulars of meat consumption from a Jewish halachic point of view are sort of now just memories. You know, there's a zecher. It's like the korbanot, you know. And so we're interested in Trumat HaDeshen and all that stuff, but we're not really doing it. So it's all receded into like our mythological memory. Yes, there'd be something lost. And yet... if the product were more ethical, more sustainable, you know, and more healthful, I think that might, you know, trump it. But, and you know, the reason to have these conversations now is we could actually influence the industry. So if, for instance, we decided that, no, this meat, the cells really should be taken from a living animal as opposed to from a dead animal, if we decided that, we might be able to sort of... at this early stage, before all industry is set up, sort of argue with these companies that they should do it that way, and then the product could wind up having a broader market. It's in their interest before they get too invested in one particular methodology. In fact, I'm planning on writing to Mark Post, who I wonder if he's a member of the tribe. I just don't know. But just to see like what his thoughts are about it. I want to see one other preparatory thing, and we'll do the chavruta. You know, in Shmini, it says zot hachaya asher tochel. Right, this is the animal that you should eat. You know, the rabbis, whenever the word zot is used, they think it means a visual clue, right? Like banenu zeh. Right, when the Ben Tzora Moreh, the parents are pointing, right? This kid, right? Which means that they can't be blind, right? Because otherwise, how could they point? You know, this is one of the many ways of getting rid of the Ben Tzora Moreh. HaChodesh HaZeh, Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, that moon is your new moon, right? So whenever the word Zeh or Zot is used like that, the rabbis see it as a visual clue, right? So they say that Moshe Rabbeinu was having a... what's that?
Most Jewish.
Oh, Mark Post, yeah. Yeah, he does. He could be.
It's so racist.
It's been genetically modified. You probably know this midrash. It's in Tanchuma, in Bechukotai, if I'm not mistaken, where it says Moshe Rabbeinu was having trouble identifying three mitzvot, right? Three things he couldn't figure out. One was the menorah, right? Maaseh menorah. How does it look? These kaftorim. I don't know what this looks like. I got branches and stuff. So God shows him a menorah of fire, right? In the sky. He also didn't know what the new moon looked like. Is it this way? Which way? And so he gets shown the moon. God mooned him. But the final one was this verse. He didn't understand it. Zot HaChaya. Because it was one thing, it says that in Vayikra Rabbah, it says that God picked up animal after animal and said, you can eat this, you can't eat that. Now you might say, well, how complicated is it, really? You know, cows, I get it. They chew their cud and they have split hooves, you know, and there's only so many variables, right? But they say, no, that wasn't what it was. It was how hard. It was trefot that were hard, because a trefa is an animal that's been mauled and isn't dead yet, right? How badly does it have to be mauled before it's considered treif? Right? The expression is kol she'ein kamahu chaya treifa. It says in Masechet Chulin, anything that it couldn't live like in that state is considered a treifa. So it's been a long time, millennia, that rabbis, and Moshe's a rabbi, then three millennia, have been worrying about exactly what kind of animals, exactly what type of damage to the animal would separate it from our ability to eat. Okay? So, let's look at some text. I have a couple of these. Here, just pass these around. Back to you. So, I did not translate anything. Sorry. But what we're going to do is maybe if people who don't have access to it in a pure Hebrew text would like to chavrut together, that'd be great. I'm actually going to read the first one out loud to you because it's just too funny. Right. So I wrote the first text. It says Basar min Hashemayim, and this is from Masechet Sanhedrin in the Bavli in Samach Amud Bet. Rav Chanina v'Rav Oshaya havu yad pekol mali shabta v'aski b'sefer Yetzira. So these two rabbis did chavruta, and they would do it every Erev Shabbos, right? And they would study Sefer Yetzira, which is this old book of mysticism written, according to some, by Adam HaRishon, right? Umivu lehu igla tilata, and they would create for themselves, right, a little calf, a three-year-old calf, right? Va'achlile, and they also ate it, right? Which leads to a whole discussion: was it milchig or fleshy? Because it wasn't shechted, apparently. Like they got this whole animal, it just dropped out of the clouds, right? And Rashi there says about the igla tilata. Gadol ke'ilu ke'ilu higia l'shalishnav the gamra gedulato. It came out of the heavens, you know, grown as if it had been around for 3 years, right? The hachi shviche, because that's the best type of lamb, I guess. But
so it just appeared before them.
Yeah, well, they sort of made it.
How?
Isn't that what we'd like to know? Could save Mark Post an awful lot of effort, right? this is what they did. So we actually have this text in the Talmud of this idea of creating new meat. And so as you start your chavruta, I thought that would be a good kavanah for you guys, which is like, I'm going to make a calf. I'm going to make, right, okay, good. So, right, don't have a cow, as Bart Simpson used to say. Right. So the first set of texts I thought we'd look at is under 2, Hayotze min haTahor Tahor, which is just saying, this idea that that kosher meat has to come from a kosher animal, right? Kosher kid has to come from a kosher mom. So in honor of Mother's Day, I guess you could read that. And then, sorry, that's gross. All right, then on the next side, we'll look at some Eber Menachai texts. So, what do we got? This session ends at 3?
3:00
or 3:00.
I think the next one's
5:00.
Yeah, 3:00. And
then that's at 3:14. Yeah, okay. So, why don't we take 10 minutes in your Chavruta just to learn through the text under number 2, and then we'll talk about them for a few minutes, and then we'll take 10 minutes on the Eber Menachai text. Okay? I heard about this.
It's got the mouthfeel and everything.
Yeah, I heard that this is good. It's, they're selling it at Whole Foods, right?
I bought a bag.
Does this mean a calf? Yeah, between a, you know, a mule is a... I don't know. Does a piranha cow, or is it... How could a cow come from a dog?
That's a good question, isn't it? Parash yalda kamin chamor. So if it was inseminated, I guess, by...
So a cow...
I don't know.
So it's just talking about crossbreeding?
Yes.
That's the...
This is talking about the chorot. Is the do you have to redeem these animals?
If they're not actually the same kind of animal,
right, right. But it's got to be the kind of animal that's mentioned in the Torah, right?
Yeah. But were these animals? Was it routine to inseminate them?
Well, they certainly made mules.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, between a horse and a donkey, right?
Right.
Right. But mules are sterile, as I understand.
Right.
Yeah.
Any crossbred animal is sterile.
Well, I guess across species, but...
But the ligers.
Right.
The ligers are sterile.
Yeah.
Right. Different breed.
So keep going because you want to get to the Mao Ba'akila. Swallow?
Yeah.
It, the fish ate another fish.
Oh, that's what I mean.
I think so, yeah.
So, we're not talking about reproduction, but that means that the fish is
Well, here they're talking about finding one animal in the stomach of another.
Okay.
Like if you caught a shark and you found a flounder inside its stomach, you know, could you eat a flounder? Right.
Okay, the toe or should I die? I'm not
sure. Which one is the target? If they handle it, it's a swallowing air. Then it's a guitar.
It's according to the one that's bigger. Enveloping the other. The anchorfish that was swallowed by a gorgon.
So if we got
a really big yellowhead tuna to swallow.
This balan here, which one's the active fish and which one's the passive? Which one's the swallowed and which one's the swallowed?
So I think the dog Temed that was swallowed by dog Temed.
We're still the fish. Okay.
Yeah.
So, let's go fishing.
Dog Tame that was swallowed by?
Dog Tame, Shibala, Dog Tahor.
Or that swallowed
by? Yeah, does that mean that was swallowed by or that swallowed by?
Oh, I see. Now you're saying this, and I'm wondering myself. So, I understood it to be an impure fish, a shark, that swallows a pure fish, a carp. Mutar b'achila, that you can eat the fish inside. V'tachor shivala dag tameh. Right. But if you find an impure, like a shrimp inside the belly of a salmon, right, asur bachila, right, because it didn't grow out of the fish. Like anything that's part of the salmon, like the salmon's roe, is kosher. Right? But think stomach contents are not necessarily kosher because they weren't produced by the salmon. That's how I understand it.
Because then shrimp would somehow be able to be permissible.
That would be found. So you just intentionally stick some shrimp in it. I had shrimp last night.
At Buddha Bodai?
Well, not Bodai. We went to Hangawi. Have you ever been to Hangawi? It's this. It's a vegan Korean place. And so I didn't order the soy protein shrimp. My wife did. I don't know. I had shrimp when I was a little kid, but it's been about 40 years now, so I don't know what it tastes like anymore.
Yeah. I got hit by a boat.
Yeah.
So if you want the milk that's in it, you have to add
the
or Hanover Yellowjacks, that you wanted to actually
have a
Right, you're right, there could be.
Well, yeah, it is talking about because this is about you. Well, and then about you.
He's still going to come after you. It's a whipping, right? Malkut Mardut is less than 39. I don't know if there's a limit to it.
So I think we're talking about the extractions from the animal, like whether or not.
So it just something came out of the shell.
Right.
And then it opens eyes, you can eat it.
About, no,
just put the whole chick in your mouth and.
Right.
48
hours.
They took him out. Somebody, either an adult or a kid who's been weaned already, they're not allowed to go back and go straight to the source. But human milk is permitted to humans. It's just that it's not considered proper to do it
once
you've been weaned. Then they before she would say, well, up until 4 or 5 years old, even if a kid stops nursing for a month and then they want to nurse a little more, that's okay. You don't have to keep related. I think they're dealing with the fact that humans are not kosher animals. So this is the exception that proves the rule, that you're allowed to eat this human product.
But you're not saying you couldn't. So a woman would lack for the sake of because I've thought of
making cheese.
Yeah, because it's hard. So if you wanted to make non-dairy creamers, that's it, but you wanted it to be more authentic, not heavily more natural. But they're saying that you can't do this once you're weaned and you can't.
Well, here they're saying you can't drink it straight from the breast, but you could drink it in a kli, right? Tonight, you have to
lower your voice.
Yeah.
So this is a precedent that from non-kosher animals, a byproduct can be ingested.
Your miscarriage. But it's sort of like the exception that proves the rule. The other one is bees, right? Because honey comes from bees. And the Chazal thought that they swallowed them and then spit them into the kaberet, you know? They didn't know that it was sort of collected pollen in the legs and excreted. Yeah. There goes your apples and honey, right? Guys, I think we're going to end this section because I want to get to the Abram and Achai. We only have 15 minutes left, all right? So you may say, well, you can question, was this the best material to learn? Well, it's interesting stuff. The principle that I'm really interested in is Hayotze min haTahor Tahor VaYotze min haTameh Tameh. That this answers one question, it seems to me, which is could you take cells from a non-kosher animal and culture them? right, into a permitted food, right? That's where I'm getting at with this, right? And from this, it would seem that the answer would be no, that the cells sort of retain the their parentage, their heredity, yes?
Unless the procedure sort of like, you know, I have this feeling, this gut instinct that cheese in rabbinic times never should have been kosher or else should have been fleshy because of the rennet, except that they say if the processing and whatever turns it into Dvar Chadash.
Right.
Well, I would ask the question, by the time you biopsy the cells, you know, culture them, change them back into stem cells,
right,
which means now they're like whatever, and then change them into something else again, couldn't you apply Dvar Chadash to that as well?
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, I've been reading a long article on enzymes in kashrut, which goes right into this, the issue of using the stomach lining to curdle the cheese. Sorry. This is Hishtamshut Be'enzymes L'Hachanat Machalim Ksherim by Rav Tzvi Schachter. That's Rabbi Schachter at YU, the one who... Anyway. The rabbis nevertheless allowed for people to use this, and not only from a shechted animal, even from a nevela, you know, that they allowed it, that they didn't consider it to be meat, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying, why did they allow that?
Well, no. I mean, look, I think that if you're going to allow it at all, it doesn't matter if it's from a kosher or non-kosher animal.
It had to be from a kosher animal, but they had this theory that the liquid that came out of this flesh, right, was separate from it, and therefore it had its own status, right? Just like... blood that comes... See, blood that's absorbed into the meat is considered part of the meat, whereas blood that's out is considered its own separate thing. Right, right. So
it would not be a Dvar Chadash because it was...
Well, I don't know if they needed to use the language of Dvar Chadash yet. They were able to say that this is not considered basar. It's not considered flesh.
Okay.
You know, we think of basar as any part of the animal, but it's not. They didn't. They considered basar to be the flesh, which is different from the bones, for instance, and the gidim all have their own stats. They were feed, but...
Well, but I also thought about Dvar Chadash here, too, and I feel like if you're actually making it into meat, then that's not a Dvar Chadash.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the process is Chadash, then it's the initial product. Even if... Maybe not technically or scientifically, but if you're making a meat, then and it came from meat, if it ended up the same way it started, then it's not Chadash.
I think part of the argument with Dvar Chadash with the rennet was that it goes through this refining process where it becomes toxic at a certain point in a pure state. So it's not ra'ui la'achilat kelev, you know, and that even a dog couldn't eat it, and therefore it sort of loses its food substance status. Whereas as Ravid is saying, you know, here you've got like a straight lineage from cells from a living animal to this chunk of meat, whatever we're going to call it, and at no point did it become inedible. You know, a dog may not have noticed it; it was microscopic. But true. I don't know. I mean, I assume that stem cells are in animals that get eaten. You know, but they're.
And I can take stem cells from the marrow of your bones.
Right.
And I think bone marrow is not.
Right, it's kosher to eat bone marrow, you know. It's
So it should come from a kosher animal, essentially.
Yes, I think it should. It should come from a kosher species of animal.
Right.
The question is, does it have to come from a shechted animal, or can it come from a live animal and be poresh minachai, something that separates from a living animal, which is a different... And that brings us to the next topic, which is the Aver Minachai. So, but about these texts that you looked at, there are all things of kosher fishies eating trophy fishies and the reverse. There is stuff about the strange situation of human milk and the prohibition on adults or even older kids drinking straight from the breast, but they can, if a woman expresses milk, then it could be drunk by other people. Yes, yes. weird world of halakha. So is there anything that someone had a question about from these texts? Because we don't have a huge amount of time to spend on them. No? All right. So let's look at Abram and Achai. And maybe, we've got 10 minutes. Do you guys want to do Chavrut again, or do you want to read together? What do you think?
Let's read together.
So let's do our psukim. Joel, since you started on Reb Noach, you see the first text there, Perek Tet.
I'm on the second side?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Right, so there we're given the heter to eat meat, but not to eat the blood, right? And so this verse is...
specifically means.
Right, so that's interesting. The meat in its living, its blood, don't eat.
Don't eat.
It seems right, but the rabbis get from this the prohibition of Iver Min Achai,
right?
That the living meat is prohibited, right? And just like blood is forbidden, so too is any meat. And so meat that's been torn from an animal is the prohibition is on the eating, not on the tearing. The tearing is Tsar Bali Chaim. Right? No, but who gets the Isser? The Isser is the person who eats it. Right? So it's interesting to me, the lab technician who does this biopsy, if he called it Abram and Achai,
it's not Chayav on it.
They're not necessarily Chayav, but whoever eats the final product, Eve, you're going to say it's still the Aver, but if you're going to say, well, they only took a few stem cells, and then those stem cells were changed into muscle cells, and then those muscle cells went through many generations, so now you're no longer eating anything that was ever part of an animal.
Right.
You're eating something that's a descendant of Abram and Achai, which Chazal had no way of imagining. We had no way of imagining, right, up until recently. So is it appropriate to even refer to this as Abram and Achai?
Right. They totally died. Ad infinitum of Abram and Achai.
Let's be crazy and say, what if they can do this with taking the stem cells of vegetables? I don't know, just taking out the cells of vegetables and create meat from it. Would we even be having this conversation?
Right, so I said at the very beginning that there's this new field of synthetic biology where they can take sort of DNA, take the code, and in theory, print, using like a 3D printer, cells that have that DNA. And this is well beyond my comprehension. I think it's well beyond the comprehension of a lot of the scientists, too. But in theory, you could have meat that... Not only is it not cut from an animal, it doesn't even come from cells of an animal. All that it comes from is the information of the cells. Right? And
this changes how I say brachot or food also. Right. Like, how can you say hamotzi lechem min haaretz if you printed bread? So
weird. And can you say shahakol bara lichvodo when God didn't make this? Right.
But God created technology.
Well, God created
DNA.
God no less made that bread than God made conventionally.
Right, all through us, right. We're the tools. But there's if you look back a couple weeks in Parshat Emor, when it talks about after V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, my computer crashed, so I'm not able to pull it up. But the line after V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, it's like 1919. So you have a Tanakh on you? Yeah, Kedoshim, you're right. You're absolutely right, Kedoshim. 1918 is V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. 1919, it says something like, Eile ha'chukim...
I'll get it.
It's a
race.
He's close.
It's not a more, it's Kedoshim.
Right.
Okay,
19, got it.
Oh, we got him. Thank you. So, et chukotai tishmeru, behem techa lo tabia, kilaim, sadcha lo tizra kilaim, ubegit kilaim shatnez lo yale alecha. Right, so keep my chukot, my chukim, et chukotai tishmeru. So keep my statutes, don't mix your animals together. Right? The Zohar on this pasuk says that hook refers to God's creation, right? God made these animals. Don't make different animals, right? Hence the prohibition on hybridization of animals, right? That you should be keeping nature the way nature is, right? And so this idea, and the Zohar builds it up, because the Zohar says that when God created the world, every blade of grass, based on the famous Midrash, but every blade of grass has this like a heavenly power that's behind it, right? And so every type of animal, every sheep that's out there, has sort of an angel sheep out there that's sort of its patron.
Plato's theory of forms.
Yes, that's right.
Platonic sheep.
Right. But if you create new forms, then you're going to create a kind of life form that doesn't have this sort of supernatural patron, right?
It's like a soulless life form.
Yes.
Right.
Well, it is. And I mean, is that a bad thing to eat a steak that is soulless? You know, that the animal, it was never connected to an animal that loved its young and was afraid and...
Isn't that better?
I would think it's better. But, here's a really dark thought. How many people here eat meat? I'm just curious. Oh, it's most of you. So, well, no, I think some vegetarians might.
Right.
I think my daughter, who's vegetarian, would say, well, if I could eat meat that you'd have to kill an animal for it, then I guess. Right. So I don't know if that's correct, but there is something about. This is very dark, and I'm not proud of this thought, but it's sort of the carnivore in people is the one that wants to be able to exhibit superiority over other animals, you know, and this idea that this was alive and it was killed, you know, and that you're eating it. I think there's something very primal there. Like I said, I'm not proud of it. I'd be happy to purge this from the human soul, but I think there's something there. Okay, two comments and then we'll look at. Yeah.
I don't think that's dark at all. First of all, I think that we, you fein nefesh,
right,
that we are. I think we have very, very little insight into the ethics, and I use the word decidedly, of much of the hunting, of folks who hunt. Right? I find nothing ethical in shooting elk from a helicopter with a high-power rifle, but that's not what most hunting is. Mm-hmm. And I think that... To explore that side of it, I would urge you in your research to talk to hunters,
right,
who eat the meat that they kill, and what is their experience of that? Because, you know, I don't think most of them are bloodthirsty, you know, killers.
And this goes back to your earlier comment also, that when you separate meat from animal life and from the hunt, perhaps, but even from the kill... You know, then something is lost. Like in a way, it's been cheapened, this flesh. You know, and that's arguably already the experience for those of us who go to a supermarket and get a package of shrink wrapped beef. You know, and it looks just like any other type of food, but it's not. It was from an animal. You know, and so I think many meat eaters would think ideally we'd actually go out and kill the animals ourselves, and then there'd be no avoiding the, you know, the interaction of this, right? Okay, you wanted to say.
Well, a long time ago, Benzie Bergman studied with us at the UJ this notion of the origin of the word bracha, which is from an even older word, baraka. Mm-hmm. And there are like two other cultures besides Jews that have this notion, and it means the life force of an animal. And so in ancient times, you would eat the heart of another animal you killed and acquire its traits. And but it's also associated with water. It's really like literally like mayim chayim, life force. And I think there is some connection when you talk about the primal sort of dark whatever. There is some connection in a way between the life you take, understanding that your own life takes life, and the notion of making a bracha, I mean, now we make them for everything, but right, you're making a bracha to acknowledge the life force of the thing you ate, not just animals, but anything you consume. and the life force behind creation when you do the birth bracha, you know, any of the brachot on Ani, you know, I think it's not so much primal as primordial.
So it's a good point, and I think you're right. I think the Torah is trying to move us away from that, though, by the prohibition of drinking blood and of eating the Eber Menachot. Right. So I think the Torah realizes it wouldn't be forbidden if it weren't attractive, right? And it's possible that you know, Lotivashel Gedi Bechalei Vemo might also be that. You know, there's something primal going on here. It may have been a fertility cultic thing to do in the spring. And so the Torah and then the rabbis are trying to sort of move us into seeing the meat as, yes, an animal that you have to be aware of where it comes from, right? But on the other hand, now it's been transformed into something which is chulin, right? The word for our meat is chulin. It's not sacred anymore.
Well, it's all, I mean, in a way, it's all transformative.
Right.
And it also transforms into you eventually.
Yes.
And this whole idea about stem cells that transform from one thing into another seems to me, in a way, sort of in keeping with that whole notion of transformation.
Okay, well, there's a lot more to study, but we don't have any more time. So I thank everyone for coming.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Please look at these texts. If you have any other ideas, feel free to shoot me an email, or I'll be here until Wednesday, so be happy to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks.